Hey Mud Podcast presents.
Good evening and welcome to the show. This is Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Derschlag. This is a pre-recorded show. We're recording a week before on Friday, November 21st, but airing on Friday, November 28th. That's Black Friday. And my guest, Chuck Collins, has been on the show a few times talking about the various books that he's written and his other work. And we're going to be talking about his latest book, Burned by Billionaires. That's just out now, or I guess it's available. But welcome to the show, Chuck. Thanks for making the time to do this and to inform the public. I just finished reading the book, and it's just we'll get into that. But it's incredible what's covered in there.
Well, thanks for having me, Jimmy, and good to be in Humboldt County.
Yeah, I know you know our area pretty well. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. And speaking of Black Friday, that's so appropriate as people are, you know, pushed to consume more and more. Little do they realize, maybe they do, that a lot of the places they're going into, whether it's Walmart or maybe they're getting a coffee at Starbucks or someone else on the corner, that they're feeding this system that is making the billionaires in this country even wealthier. And that's a lot of what that impetus behind consumption is about. So I guess this is a very appropriate day for this show to be airing.
Absolutely. And another way to think of it is we all pay a tax to the billionaires. So if you're if you're outside of kind of very locally owned businesses and services, you're funneling money, you're contributing to money funneling upward, sometimes against your will. I mean, it might be that you're paying for health services or veterinary care or something else, and the billionaires have figured out a way to extract money from your paycheck.
And I should say that you are the director of program on inequality and the common good at the Institute for Policy Studies, a great organization based in DC, and also co-edit divestinvest.org, the Institute for Public Accuracy website, accuracy.org, and have written many, many books. Born on Third Base, One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home and Committee to the Common Good. Just I know several others. I should also mention that Burned by Billionaires, the subtitle is very important, How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and the Planet. And I think that's the... You know, there's good places to start. You cover so much information. I know even in this pre-recorded hour interview, we're not going to cover it all. But I don't think it's a surprise to many Americans, especially anyone paying attention, that the elite, the wealthy elite, just like for the 1% movement and others, there's been a lot of attention paid and people are aware of the large inequality gap. They may not be sure what to do about it. I think they're aware about it. But what this book showed me is how much more extreme it is than you can imagine, than I can imagine. And I deal with this topic a lot. It's just the revelations are just outrageous about how much billionaires control. And you start out by saying, showing how this wealth is accumulated. But also, I think what is very interesting, you create neighborhoods of wealth in here. They sound like Asian neighborhoods, some of them. Richistan, I love that. But maybe go into that a little bit about the various levels of wealth and accumulation and what they mean.
Yeah. Just a coda to what you said is, I think we're the last 5 years, we've seen kind of an acceleration of this upward concentration of wealth. I provide a little geographical tour through who is wealthy and where does wealth and power live. And, there's, I call it Affluentville, the top 10% of households, the richest 10%. But then we have lower, middle, and upper richistan, which is really the top 3% of households. Middle richistan, if you are in middle richistan, you're in the top 1%. Households with, $15 million and up. And then there's this dividing line, in my mind, between where does wealth convert to power? Obviously, billionaires have tremendous power. As of this morning, there are 920 billionaires with combined wealth in the U.S. of $8 trillion. That's up from $3 trillion 5 years ago. So the billionaire class has doubled their wealth in less than 5 years. But I kind of point out that when you live in upper richistan, with people with, $40, $50 million or more, you're in that top 0.1%. And, if you live in any of these villages, you live a comfortable life and you have, comfortable homes and your children are well protected and they don't have any college debt or whatever, and you are living a very good life and you have a lot of agency. But when you get more than that, you're not just buying another car or another boat or a house. You're buying a senator, or you're buying a media outlet, or you're using your wealth as a form of power to hire wealth managers to help you hide your money and reduce your taxes, or lobby to influence the public policy space around your business or whatever. So, I argue this, when I say the billionaire class, I'm really talking about that top 1/10 of 1%. And it's basically about 130,000 households in the U.S. A lot of people live in California. California is a thriving home to upper richistan residents. But that's what's important to me, is to say, look, that's where the power lies. And if we want to fix the system where that little segment of the ultra wealthy are kind of lording over us, we need to focus our policies and initiatives on that top 0.1%, 40 million and up.
And that's even before we get to the billionaireville. That's the upper richistan and billionaireville. The billionaireville where 800, you say, approximately American billionaires control over half of the amount of money, the $7 trillion, is the whole rest of American households, which is, that's even less than 0.1%, just a very small percentage of the population. One of the things that was interesting to me about these distinctions, which, informative to see those breakdowns, is that in the lowest, even though it's in the top 10 to 3% of American families in affluent town, when you think of a household income at $110,000, that doesn't seem like that much. There's got to be a lot more than the 10% in there. But I think what you're doing is when it's the wealth attached to that, that puts them into that situation. Because I think most Americans would say, oh, $110,000, even if they're household income isn't that much, that they're probably close to that, a lot of households, but it's that wealth that makes the difference.
Yeah. And, we talk a lot about income, but we don't really understand the power of wealth and assets. If I were going to do this again, I would add another village. There's a sort of group of subset of billionaires, that 26 billionaires have more than 50 billion dollars in wealth. And just to kind of underscore, the bottom 20% of households in the U.S. have no wealth, zero or negative wealth. The next 20% have very little cushion savings to fall back on, one car repair away, one medical bill away from insolvency. And, you know, 60% of the society lives paycheck to paycheck or waiting for a Social Security check at the beginning of the month. So, you know, juxtapose this extraordinary pool of wealth at the top with the fact that the vast majority of people have no financial reserves. That's an important part of the story we're trying to tell.
And I think going into this from the very beginning, because I'm sure it's something that comes up right away, and it's this explanation that is at the top of anyone who's trying to defend their wealth is this myth that these people earned it, that, you know, they deserve it. Well, who are we to question whether someone who has worked to their the bones of building their wealth, whether they deserve it or not. And I think it's that myth that keeps getting put out there that perpetuates a lot of this push towards accumulating more wealth.
Yes. You know, it's the stories that we tell about wealth that justify these extreme inequalities. We need to sort of look more closely. You know, there's a very common story about entrepreneurial wealth. I should say right off the top, half of the wealth probably transfers to people through inheritance. So the main skill that those folks have is picking their parents, which, right, as we know,
they were,
is somewhat arbitrary.
Born right into the right.
So yeah, half the wealth is by virtue of born on third base, or the lucky sperm club, as Warren Buffett called it. But, you know, there is this stage of wealth accumulation where people start a business and maybe they create something successful and useful. Jimmy, you invent a new mouse trap that's better than any other mouse trap, and we all want to buy that. And you should be rewarded for that. So that's, you know, that's kind of the entrepreneurial success story. But what we don't realize is when you have levels of wealth in that $40, $50 million and up to the billionaires, you've probably figured out how to manipulate and use the system to get more wealth. So, you know, you move to the next stage of wealth defense. You're defending your mousetrap business and empire. You're blocking competition. You're using your wealth to lobby and change the regulatory environment around your business. And then when you get to this billions of level wealth, you're using your wealth to kind of extract more wealth from the economy. You're using your clout and your monopoly power to extract rents from everyone else. And that's where, you know, it's no longer a story of entrepreneurial wealth or virtuous wealth creation. It's a plundering extraction story. And so it's a little complicated to talk about this because we want to say, hey, isn't it great you started that business? And Jimmy, that's an awesome mousetrap. It's only when you're way up there where you're flexing your power muscles to defend your wealth and expand it. That's when we as a society are like, the story of deservedness doesn't work anymore.
And of course, as you mentioned, the wealth defense where you're okay, you've got your money, now you're doing whatever you can to keep it, minimizing your taxes, maybe exerting monopoly control over certain business segments, and then influencing politics. I think we'll probably talk more about that. And also we'll talk about the various hyper extraction methods in different market sectors, because I think that's very critical. But this dynasty aspect is what I think is so important to be aware of, because so much of what they're doing is they can't spend it in their lifetimes, these billionaires. And so much of their sure, they want to make more, but is figuring out methods to pass it on to their families, and create these dynasties. And it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy that keeps this very small group of people in a position where they can control so much of business, government, everything else. And so far, the government has gone along with supporting that. You talk about the inheritance tax. Well, there was a time when it was very natural to have major inheritance tax, and that's no longer the case.
Yeah, and I think you're making an important point, is for us to understand that these are policy choices. The rules of the economy have been changed to benefit asset owners at the expense of wage earners. And yeah, we used to have a very robust inheritance tax. It sort of discouraged the accumulation of dynastic wealth, for, you know, the children and grandchildren of the ultra-rich didn't inherit billions and billions of dollars. That's been changed. You know, we've weakened, almost effectively abolished the estate tax, the inheritance tax. There's been a whole, the billionaires have waged a powerful campaign to eliminate the death tax and confuse people about who actually pays it. So one of the important policy breaks on dynastic wealth accumulation has been effectively dismantled. The solution is obviously we need to have a robust inheritance tax. We need to probably have an annual wealth tax above a certain level and a progressive income tax. All those tax policies have been riddled with holes and loopholes, and we don't enforce tax rules anymore. The capacity of the oversight tax agencies to follow the money and close down all the elaborate shell games has been greatly weakened. So the ultra rich are basically opting out of taxes, which means you and I and everyone, all the people listening, are picking up the slack, paying the bills, because the ultra rich aren't paying their fair share.
I do want to remind the listeners, this is Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Derschlag. This is a pre-recorded show. We're talking with Chuck Collins, who is the director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. He co-edits inequality.org. There's another divestinvest.org, another website. And his latest book that we're discussing, Burned by Billionaires, How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and the Planet. And that is available now through the typical outlets, would you say?
Absolutely, yeah. No, people can find it. If you go to burnedbybillionaires.com, there's links to sort of the independent online retailers.
Yeah, use that
but,
one.
But yeah, you know, check out, is it Northtown Books in Arcata and some
yes.
of the great local bookstores?
Yes.
And if they don't have it, ask them to order it and get your local library to order it. I think, so the book is out there. It's selling really well. People are really interested in this topic. In fact, I would say we're at a moment of people recognizing the harms of concentrated wealth and really starting to take action to talk about what we can do about that.
Yeah, well, I would hope so. Certainly, maybe there's a glimmer of hope in the recent political expressions, especially that came out in these last in-between term elections, that you never can read too much into that. But certainly, the Republican Party is arguing it with itself a little bit, which may help out as well. And, we have in the White House now the perfect supporter for extreme wealth. He's gilding the lily. Everything has to be gold, tearing down the White House to build a monument, gold leaf monument to himself. So, it's just, again, it's unfathomable to me how people go along with that. And maybe there are some shifts. I hate to even ask if the book's on Amazon as we talk about a major billionaire in this whole process. Mr. Bezos, but it's something that people use. So it maybe that's one thing. It's not a great business to support, but if you can get good stuff off of it, I would not go against that. Use it for good, right? If possible. Going on to, you know, the bulk of the book, part two, The Billionaire Burn, How the Wealth of a Few Impoverishes the Many, the chapters go into the details of each of the areas where the billionaires are affecting us and in negative ways. And so much of that is really remarkable, the details you give in there. And I do want to cover several of them, but I want to start out with something that was more, I didn't really understand that well, and I'm still trying to understand that, which is, you know, there's so much talk in the elections. All of the candidates for president talked about it, is the whole housing issue about, you know, I'm working here. We have a grant that I helped create for putting the homeless out of encampments into both interim and permanent housing. And we know there's a housing crisis in the country, not just for the houseless, but for, middle income people can't afford to buy houses. People who would normally be on a path to, you know, okay, we could at least get a down payment and pay monthly payments. We can get a house. That was a standard way to step up. And now so many people, even being paid fairly well, let alone those at minimum or low paying jobs, are really not able to have a path to home ownership. And I think the thing about that chapter, The Billionaires Are Wrecking the Housing Market, is, you know, so much of the conversation was we need more housing. We need to build more housing. You know, we don't have it. But there's a huge amount of actually available housing out there that is controlled by billionaires or the ultra wealthy that isn't even being made available to people. So that's either by their price or just they're keeping it for other. So maybe you can talk about that more, because I think that's an area people really don't understand. At least I need more information.
Yeah. And a lot of these are kind of, I call them sort of invisible forces. And most of the time people say, oh, yeah, affordable housing, we just need to build more housing. Well, the reality is, when you have these levels of inequality, they kind of almost supercharge the housing crisis. And as you say, it's not just people being unsheltered, it's people living in rental housing, paying half their income for housing, or it's people who, you know, are in a position that, and hope to own their own home, but the market is such that if you're not really wealthy, you're not in the game. And a lot of people go out and try to buy a home, and they're competing against people who are paying cash for with no inspection, and you just can't compete against that kind of wealth. So one way to think about it is that the housing crisis is being supercharged by these inequalities. And a couple ways are, one, the rich buy more houses. They're buying up houses and land. They bid up the cost of land and housing. But there are these billionaire-backed investment funds where the ultra-wealthy are buying up rental housing and converting it to short-term rental, or they're buying up single-family homes because people are not in a position to own their home, but they want to live in a single family home with a yard. So they're these big, you know, Blackstone, these giant $1 trillion private equity funds are buying up single family homes and renting them to people with the idea that they're just going to rent them their whole lives, never own. I see these vulture investors buying up mobile home parks. Mobile home parks are, you know, the residents don't really have another easy place to move. One of these billionaires said, oh, I love buying mobile home parks. You can, you know, it's like owning a Waffle House where the customers are chained to the counter, you know, you have nowhere to go. So these are all examples where inequality is fueling the housing crisis. And in Los Angeles, there's, you know, tens of thousands of vacant units. They've been bought by the ultra wealthy, not as homes, but as kind of like safe deposit boxes in the sky. It's just a way to, a place to park your wealth and hold its value. And you have 36,000 people without homes, and you have the same amount of empty luxury apartments and units. So you can see all the ways in which the wealthy are kind of exacerbating an already bad housing crisis.
And what is it, I guess, what is the benefit of like buying up these condos and keeping them vacant? Is that just for future speculation? It seems like the value is going to be putting people in there. So the notion that they actually just buy these places and keep them vacant, what is that value to them?
Well, this is where you kind of have to put yourself, Jimmy, into the shoes of your inner billionaire. You got $1 billion. What are you going to do with it? Well, okay, so some of that's going to be maybe invested in housing where that's a form of income. But when you have that level of wealth, you're just looking for places to park and hold value. Bill Gates is the largest owner of farmland in the United States,
right?
Not because he's interested in farmland or farming, but because he just has so much wealth that he needs to spread it around to lots of different asset classes, is what the investor advisors say, So Jimmy, you got $1 billion, you should put some of it over here in art, and some of it in bonds, and some of it in corporate equities, but a lot of that's going to go to real estate. And so part of what's happening is that the rich have so much money, they're just buying up real estate all over the country, building luxury houses, not to live in, but to just as a way to hold the value of their assets. Which isn't to say some of it isn't being rented or invested in for purposes of income, but some of it's just wealth preservation.
And just to take a small step back before we go out to other of these areas that you cover, is that you mentioned the single family housing and buying them up. What is it, 40% of single family homes in the country are owned by this wealthy class?
Well, I think it's, that's where we're heading. I think that was the projection that within 10 years, 40% of investor single family homes will be owned by investors, in the single family homes that are being rented. So that's a significant trend. I actually walked some neighborhoods in Minneapolis with some organizers where, half the single family houses on a block were owned by these outside investors. And that's kind of, so you don't even know who your landlord is in some cases. You don't even know who owns the property next door. You might know your neighbor, but you didn't know that their house is owned by Jeff Bezos's investor group.
Yeah.
So that's one of those invisible forces that's changing the whole housing economy.
And probably there's some real estate management firm that they've hired in that area that's going to do... That's the person you send your check to and you call when the plumbing breaks and you wait a few months for them to fix it. But you're not seeing the real ownership, which brings up another important topic that cuts across all of these areas where the billionaires are making and the ultra wealthy are making this impact, which is the enablers. That there's a whole group, whether it's lawyers or other white collar, basically, firms or agencies or people who are living off the way, maybe some of them are in that 10% if they have enough clients, but mostly below that, who are enabling this whole process.
Yeah. And that's a very important class. Many of them are in the top 10%. They certainly kind of are upward focused. They know their bread is buttered by the ultra wealthy, and they basically are part of the service class. They are tax attorneys and accountants and wealth managers who help the rich create trusts and anonymous shell companies and offshore bank accounts to sort of move their money around the planet and avoid tax. They're the lobbyists who lobby to defend and block policies that are very popular in many cases, but block them on behalf of the ultra wealthy. And they're well rewarded for the work they do. There's a whole enabler class that helps the ultra rich stay wealthy and get more of our wealth.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
Again, I want to remind the listeners, this is a pre-recorded show. Sorry, no call-ins for that. That's only because I think the day this airs, Black Friday and the 28th, that's a hard day for everyone's busy that day. So, well, maybe while you're sitting in your post-Turkey Day haze, you listen in and hear about this topic. But my guest is Chuck Collins. So glad to have him back on. Always great to talk with him. We're talking about his book just out now, Burned by Billionaires, How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and Planet. And he is the director of program on inequality and the common good at the Institute for Policy Studies, author of many books on the subject, trying to hold these wealthy accountable. And I do want to mention the book that we had you on about when it first came out, Born on Third Base, a One Percenter Makes the Case for Tracking Inequality. I don't want to spend a lot of time on that, but people should know that you were a silver spoon guy and did get a large inheritance. I don't know how much, but that you chose to divest yourself and invest in important causes. So I think it's worthwhile for the listeners to know that you are committed yourself, as a money where your mouth is kind of phrase.
Yeah, you know, I was born on third base, and if I'd held on to the wealth, I'd be in middle Richistan today. But I also was very kind of concerned about a society with too much inherited wealth. I think it's bad for me, it's bad for the recipients, and it's bad for society. And, you know, that was 40 years ago that I made that decision. But what I see is there's a whole young generation of people with inherited wealth who were born on third base, but they really believe that they want to redistribute the wealth to build a society that works for everybody. It's not a large group, but it's a small and significant movement, really, of people who, you know, believe too much wealth is bad for society. Too much, you know, concentrated wealth in the hands of a few is not good. So, yeah, I see that. That's good news. You know, there's these sort of cracks within the wealth holding system, even among the enablers. You know, I worked with a bunch of wealth advisors. I wrote another book that you and I talked about called The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. And, you know, that was there are people who read that book and have called me up and said, hey, I want to help dismantle the hidden wealth system. I want to lobby to eliminate trusts that are abusive. So the good news is, even among the progressive advisors and you know, the wealth managers, there are people who are willing to join the team to reduce inequality.
And I know this isn't in your book, but just as an aside, because it's something that I think about a lot, is there's also this like influencer generation. There never was a job description called an influencer when I was growing up, where it seems like that's the opposite. But I guess it's always that way. Part of what supports the billionaires and their ability to do what they do is this aspirational aspect of people saying, oh, yeah, I want that, too. I want to be a billionaire. I want to earn this money. And now you've got this whole generation that what they're basically doing is just going on creating followers and trying to aggrandize themselves. I don't know if you have any comment on
that. Yeah, no, I mean, actually, I start the book with that great song, the lyrics from that song, I Want to Be a Billionaire.
Yeah.
And I think that's an aspiration. You know, my argument to that view is the billionaires are pulling up the ladder of opportunity. They're going to make it harder for you to become rich or just have a decent life. You know, the affordability squeeze, and that's kind of the political buzzword of the moment.
Yeah, everybody's using that, including Trump.
Yeah, and it's a reflection of the fact that real wages have been flat, stagnant for decades. Productivity gains have gone to wealth holders, not to the workers who are doing the work. And, you know, it's kind of created this unfortunate. And then the wealth extractors are raising the costs. You know, they're raising the cost of healthcare. They're raising the cost of groceries. That's not an accident. That's because these wealthy, powerful people can dominate huge sectors of the economy and extract money and rents from the rest of us. I don't mean rents like a landlord tenant rent, but a, you know, what economists call rents. You know, you, when you buy something on an app, or you use Uber, or you, you know, use Rover.com to hire a dog walker, somebody is skimming money off of every transaction. And that's where a lot of the big tech billionaire money comes from creating technologies that we're all chipping a nickel every time we use it. So, you know, that's part of what's, you know, affecting everyone's ability to just have economic stability and affordability.
Let's talk about a few other areas. I mean, the chapters go into a lot of different ones about, you've mentioned already, how about it affects when you take away from these other tax sources like the estate tax or we haven't talked about corporate tax, but that's an important one, that it ends up that the lower income pay more taxes. But you've also talked about how it it impacts the racial economic divide. But another area that's, of course, important to the listeners in our community is the environment. And you talk about how they're trashing the planet. And, you can think about that, and it, certainly that applies in terms of the bigger impacts like harvesting, you know, deforestation, logging, and other areas. But just by their own personal footprints, their yachts, the jets, they themselves have this huge impact as individuals, which you don't really think about.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the ultra wealthy are the super emitters. You know, the headline here is the super rich are trashing our environment. They're burning our planet and they're blocking our ability to respond. They're blocking alternatives to the fossil fuel meltdown. But as you point out, you know, if you think about it, the ultra rich, they have more houses, they fly on private jets, which is indefensible on a global warming planet. They power these yachts around the world. Oxfam just did a study. You know, most Americans, the average carbon footprint per year is about 14 tons of emissions. That includes everything, housing and food and commuting expenses. The billionaires are the top 0.1% emit 2.2 tons per day. Larry Ellison emits 7,000 tons of carbon emissions just by trotting around the world in his yacht, not even counting his whole Hawaiian island full of houses. So the ultra rich are the super emitters. Now, the rest of us who emit whatever 14 tons, that's still a lot from a global perspective. The global average is about 4 tons. Each of us need to adjust our level of consumption and reduce our carbon footprint. But the billionaires have to make the biggest changes and the most fast, and they should do it before everyone else. And I make this point that this undercuts the fact that the billionaires are the super emitters and are the least likely to change their behavior, undercuts that sense of solidarity. I mean, Jimmy, you think, oh, okay, maybe I need to do my part, but then you hear that, you know, Kylie Jenner's just flying their jet across town for lunch in LA and burning up tens of thousands of pounds of carbon over a short period. And, you know, what are we, chumps? Well, how are we going to form that sense of shared sacrifice and solidarity we're going to need to face a disrupted future? So, you know, the climate disruption is a billionaire issue. And then there's this segment of the climate criminal, you know, billionaires that I call them the climate criminals. They're the oil and gas and coal barons. They're the ones who are lobbying to close down windmill projects and keep open zombie coal plants that are have been scheduled to be closed. They're using their wealth and power and position to block climate fixes and run out the clock. So, this whole chapter on this, but and I could go on and on, but I think the important point is we're not going to fix this climate crisis with these extreme inequalities of power.
Certainly, there's been one of the chapters you talk about this and the affecting the vote and the voice. And it's certainly not a topic that's being ignored. There was a movement for public support of campaigns, which kind of has fallen by the wayside because the amount that people, that candidates could get, especially at the upper levels for president or other, probably Senate as well, the amount that candidates could get by opting into public financing was so much less than what the campaigns cost. I mean, just talking about the cost of campaigns, which is a whole other huge topic in and of itself, they just couldn't afford to be in the running without, except if they accepted the public financing. But just the support right now, I mean, even the fact that that big, ugly bill could get passed with, as you say, the billionaires have already, the wealthy already have more than they need, and yet what was passed was more tax cuts for those at the top. The mere fact that that could get passed shows the voice that they have. And you go into that, and it's worth keeping that topic because just how we change that tendency the wealthy controlling elections. You talk about how a dollar invested in supporting a candidate from that segment, the wealthy segment, has this huge return on investment.
Yeah, I mean, I think the bottom line is we're having our voice and our vote basically robbed of by wealth. Our political system has been hijacked, and this is not probably news to a lot of your listeners. It's kind of obvious, but you know, we're not going to be able to. And we've tried to implement campaign finance reforms to limit the influence of money on politics, but I'm kind of at the point where I'm like, you know, the way to defend our democracy at this point is to tax extreme wealth, to diminish wealth and power. Money is like water running down a hill. It's just wants to influence. You could put up a barrier and the water's just going to run around it. And so at this point, and a lot of the way in which the wealthy exercise their power is to block very popular things. You know, most people think we should have a public option healthcare system, a sort of Medicare for all, Medicaid for all. That's popular. Taxing the wealthy to fix big problems. Incredibly popular. 75% of voters, including majority of Republicans, know the rich aren't paying their fair share and should pay their fair share. So these are popular policies and legislative initiatives that the wealthy use their clout to block and keep us from moving toward the society we want to live in. So that's a huge part of our problem. And, the solution obviously is, you know, you can try to implement campaign finance laws or create a public financing system to compete with private money. But at this point, we're not going to get there. We're not going to save our democracy with campaign finance reform. We have to sort of reverse this concentration of wealth and power to save democracy.
And there are some, you mentioned in H.R. 1, I mean, I do want to get into some of the fixes for this as well. So you mentioned that there are some things that people are putting forth, although you're saying that public financing is probably not going to make it, but things like donor disclosures. And I was interested in this. I hadn't heard about that. Democracy vouchers in Seattle, giving voters $100 in democracy vouchers to contribute to local candidates. And, you know, of course, we've gone on this show talked many times about things like ranked choice voting or multiple candidates in districts or things that can allow for a more equitable or at least giving more possibilities for something other than just the two choices that people have. So there's other things that are not necessarily financially related to change the structure. But I do want to get into some of the other issues. I remind the listeners, this is Global Stuff. This is a pre-recorded show, recording on the 21st, airing a week later on the 28th of November. My guest, Chuck Collins, so glad that he made the time, and welcome him back to the show. Always a treat. Burned by Billionaires, How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and Planet, his latest book. It's so stacked with information, but not a long one. So don't be put off by, you know, a lot of these, nonfiction books can be thick. And I think this is a great read and one that's certainly worthwhile checking out. So available online. As I said, I just briefly talk about these other pack. We talked about the environment, taxes, the housing market, we could go into detail about the health system and how all the taking over for-profit hospital ownerships, which used to be nonprofits or religious organizations, going into the emergency rooms and the kind of even the pet market it's like cherry picking them and taking over what they see as the most profitable segments of a lot of different parts of the economy or the service industry. So, you know, that I encourage people to go in and check that out. But I do want to get into, you know, which is so important, is, as you say, in the final section, protecting yourself and your community from the billionaire burn, what you see as the steps that we can take to improve the situation in the country and counteract this enormous influence of the ultra wealthy on our system.
You know, the first step is still sort of educational. It's talking to our neighbors about the ways we are being burned by billionaires. It's looking at our own budgets and how much of that money is getting extracted and moving to the billionaire class. But in terms of protecting our communities, I think, for instance, I think we should, you know, and we don't have to wait for Washington, D.C. to change. There's a lot of state and local things defending the local economy from the wealth extractors, supporting small businesses, independent organizations. I see all these campaigns that address the affordability issue by taxing billionaires. So Zoran Mamdani ran for mayor of New York City.
Yeah, that was a surprise to everyone, it seemed like.
Yeah, but he was talking about, I'm going to address affordability by taxing the incomes of millionaires, and we're going to use that money to make free buses and modern childcare system and address the housing crisis. And that was incredibly popular, and it pulled people out, and it disaffected or unengaged voters came out to vote because they saw they could vote for something that would make a difference. But I think in the book, I talk about game-changing campaigns where people fight for something they really care about. And the fix is tied to taxing billionaires. So, for instance, luxury real estate. Now, California and a lot of jurisdictions in California tax luxury real estate and fund affordable housing. Oakland, San Francisco, LA all have luxury real estate transfer taxes that go into funds for affordable housing. Or taxing private jet fuel. You know, private jets are you know, indefensible on a warming planet. They hardly pay their real fair share of the use of the airspace, tax their fuel more heavily, you know, 10 times the current taxes, and use those monies to invest in green infrastructure and, you know, green transit. And voters in California, you all next year are going to get to vote on an emergency billionaire wealth tax to tax billionaires and fund the rising cost of health care for millions of Californians. You will probably have a chance to vote on that next year. But those are all these campaigns. And note, they are state and local, but they will help build a movement toward addressing taxation at the national level. So, things that connect affordability with taxes on the rich. And again, we need to raise the minimum wage, raise the floor. The federal minimum wage has not been raised since 2009.
And there's been movements to do that, but they all seem to get short-circuited. Haven't there even been proposals put before Congress for that?
Congress has not had a vote to raise the minimum wage since 2009. So that's an example where the wealthy and powerful use their clout to block raising the minimum wage is popular. Even in red states and, you know, like the Dakotas, when there's been a ballot question to raise the state minimum wage, it passes overwhelmingly. So people understand they need to raise the wage floor, and workers should share in the productivity gains that they've been part of. So that's, you know, that's an example where these are things that we can do, where we have agency and a room to move.
If you were going to craft a message that would, you know, you say when we talk about oligarchs or plutocrats or even billionaires, it's not necessarily those words that, you know, Bernie Sanders is a great communicator about that whole concept, probably the strongest along with AOC perhaps and a few others about that situation. And yet people don't really respond to that. If you're reaching out to especially the next generation of voters and many younger people who have decided it's not even worthwhile to vote, what kind of a message would you think might resonate with them?
Well, I think the message of the incoming mayor of New York is reaching younger people. It's, hey, your future has been hijacked. The environment has been hijacked and the economy has been hijacked by the billionaires. And so we need to organize. We need elected officials to fight for working people in our society and stand up to the billionaires and stand up to the donor class. You know, a lot of political candidates and people who hold office, they hear from their wealthy donors, you know, oh, Jimmy, you don't want to be talking that way. You don't want to, that's class war, or don't attack the rich. You know, that's anti-rich. And you know, I'm your donor and I give you $200, you know, or I give you a PAC donation. And so the question is, will our politicians side with the donor class or with their working class constituents? And if not, we need candidates who are willing to run. And I believe they'll win if they campaign for law change, you know, policies that lift up everybody, not just the rich.
In just a couple minutes we have left, I'd be lax if I didn't point out that we are a public community radio station. In fact, several days after this airs, we're doing like an extended Giving Tuesday fundraiser from Monday through Wednesday of the next week. One of the sections you talk about how nonprofits, the billionaires hide a lot of their money in nonprofits, but they're not really using that. And of course, the actions by Congress to defund money that had already been allocated to public media. So I think it's so important to emphasize to our listeners, and perhaps there's trends that can become national to reverse that that tendency of, you know, labeling everything as well, the president's calling us traitors, you know, but here you are listening to this show and showing some of the trends that are really hurting the majority of people in this country. And we need to keep that alive and get this information out to the public.
Yeah, no, your listeners should know that having an independent radio station where we can have these kind of conversations is absolutely a cornerstone of a healthy democratic society. So support KMUD, support independent nonprofits that are doing work in our communities to solve problems. If you have those kind of funds, you know, what's happened is as wealth has concentrated, it's totally changed charity and philanthropy in the nonprofit sector. The rich give differently. They're not going to give to a community radio station. They're more likely to give to a hospital where they're going to have their name on the wing, or universities, or elite culture. That's where the wealthy give. And they give money not to directly to nonprofits. Often they give huge amounts of money to their own private foundations and donor advice funds. And then, you know, it doesn't move very fast. It just sort of trickles out over generations in some cases. So, you know, billionaire charity is not the answer. But independent people giving small donations to organizations that matter in their community, that's how we're going to get through these difficult times.
Well, thanks so much, Chuck. It's really always a pleasure, as I said, to speak with you. We appreciate you making the time. Chuck Collins, the director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, his latest book, Burned by Billionaires, How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and Planet. You can check various websites, inequality.org, divestinvest.org, and accuracy.org. Check out that and other books. Such important work that you're doing, and we're glad to have you on the show to talk about that.
Thanks, Jimmy, and thanks to the people of Humboldt County listening in on Friday night. I hope you have a good Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And take care, and appreciate people having these conversations with their neighbors, and check out the book.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, kmud.org.